Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. You know, words can mean everything when it comes to a meaningful dialogue on issues of the day. This week, discussion is centered on questions of racial justice as we mark the second anniversary of Michael Brown's shooting death in Ferguson. Joining me in studio is St. Louis-based poet, writer, activist Jackie Germain, a Washington University graduate who has focused a lot on the spate of police shootings of young black men. She is the author of a book of poetry, When the Ghosts Come Ashore is the title, and Jackie Germain joins me in studio. Nice to see you.
Good to see Thanks you. So Thank much. You for having me.
This I mentioned just before we went on the air, this has been a busy week for you. As an outsider, you grew up in Ohio, came to Washington University, and refused to leave, from what I can understand. How do you view, as an outsider, if I may put it that way, Ferguson and its aftermath?
Yeah, so I think, I got to St. Louis, moved to St. Louis in 2008. So I'd been here for several years before August of 2014. But I think as a transplant, one of the things that I had the opportunity to do was sort of understand that although I had lived in the city for a long time, I wasn't born and raised there, right? So I had a different understanding. I had a different relationship with the city, especially because my introduction to St. Louis was through a university that very much is regarded in St. Louis as sort of a bubble, right? So I think I had a certain level of respect, certainly, for the residents there and a certain level of hesitation in terms of how much space I took up in the conversation, in terms of whose perspective I needed to listen to and prioritize as someone who cares a lot about the city but wasn't born and raised here. I didn't grow up on the streets of, you know, on West Florissant, for example. I didn't grow up around Ferguson. I didn't grow up in Normandy. But I have a lot of respect for the city and for the residents and for understanding what that experience was like.
What motivated you to stay? I mean, St. Louis is not an easy place for an African-American to live.
For sure, yeah. So I think in two parts. I think for the first part, I enjoyed staying here because I grew up in a suburb. And although I want to think of myself as a big city girl, this is a good in between for me. I think maybe the second and larger reason is because of the people that I met in St. Louis. I kind of fell in love with the city because of the relationships and the friendships that I built here. Some of whom were at WashU, but many of whom were out of the university setting. I think I love the art scene here. I think it's blossoming in some really innovative ways that you don't see in really big cities. And I think the people here are really interested in the city itself, which is really powerful.
Is it a good place to write poetry?
I think it is. I think it really is. I think there aren't a lot of narratives coming out of St. Louis right now into the national space, and I think that's a shame because I think there are some really fantastic writers in St. Louis, but a lot of the writers who get privileged in those spaces are writers who went to MFA programs in St. Louis or who are transplants like me. So I'm always thinking, as a writer who is a transplant to St. Louis, how can I elevate the voices of writers who've been here for decades and been writing, who were here during the Black Arts Movement in St. Louis?
Well, let's talk a little bit about that writing.
For sure.
I'm curious, the book, When the Ghosts Come Ashore, about the ghosts, what are we talking about?
Yeah, so I think I was sort of interested in writing. So history is my other second passion. And I was interested in writing a story or thinking about a narrative in which the ghosts that we sort of push back across these historical narratives, what would happen if they could come back? What would happen if the way that we think of time is like this linear thing? What if it wasn't linear? What if it was cyclical? What if, right, what if those ghosts, what if those our ancestors, what if those past events could come back and directly influence the way that we see the world now, the way that we interact with the world now? So those ghosts are sort of a calling back to that history, bringing it into present space and sort of seeing what that does now.
And who are some of those ghosts that you've drawn upon?
Well, yeah. So I have a series of poems, actually, two of which are in the book, but I think it's a five or six part series now that are in conversation with Nat Turner, which has been a lot of fun, but also really difficult to write about. But one of the cool things about poetry is that you get to right? Like, imagine these sort of fictional conversations that act as some sort of social commentary. So Nat Turner is one of them. I have a couple different sort of characters. I obviously appear in the book. Not as a good.
Well, right. Explain to our audience who Nat Turner was. Those who have not read The Confessions of Nat Turner may not know.
Yeah, so Nat Turner actually was an enslaved person who led one of the biggest slave revolts in American history in the States. And he was of the Christian faith. He believed that God told him that it was, you know, right time to rise up and sort of like free his brothers and sisters, his fellow enslaved people. And he went on and ended up going across several plantations with his fellow enslaved folks who had freed themselves. And and following that, he went into hiding, and sort of there's a whole story behind that as well.
Well, after reading your poems, folks should read William Styron's Confessions of Nat Turner,
sure.
Which is a wonderful story,
yeah.
a very inspiring story. Mm-hmm. What about Michael Brown? Does he come into your writing?
Michael Brown is not specifically in the book, but I do have poems about St. Louis that are very much influenced by sort of the events of the fall of 2014. So the manuscript actually was finished June or July of 2014. And then when I went to the editing process after it was accepted with the small press that published my book, I ended up editing some of the poems and putting in more poems about St. Louis because it felt more relevant to me in terms of the story that I wanted to tell with the chapbook. So I do have narratives about St. Louis, obviously, in it, but not poems specifically about Michael Brown. I have poems about the protest. I have poems about that kind of thing. But
you are described as an activist. Were you actively involved in the protests?
I was going out every night. I was in school full time at the same time. I also had a part time job at the same time. As were, you know, many of the protesters also had full time jobs, also had families, also had kids, right? Also were students. I was there throughout the fall and a little bit into the winter. I'm still really good friends with the protest community here in St. Louis, which I'm very lucky to have spent time with and know.
How effective have the protests been, do you think?
I think they've been incredibly effective in the sense that we've seen a sort of sociopolitical shift across our country and across the world, I think, in the way that people think of resistance. And be that around racial injustice, be that around environmentalism, be that around, right, a number of different things, police brutality being, you know, the one here in the States that I think a lot of people think about. But there are so many different other issues. And I think people are thinking of resistance differently than they were thinking of it before August of 2014. I think there's been a resurgence in this understanding of what your role as a citizen means or could mean. I think there's a resurgence in investigating history as we were maybe told it, and thinking of it differently, right? I think there are a lot of different shifts on a lot of different areas that have happened, but I think it was definitely really effective.
You know, I'm curious, when you woke up this morning and heard that there had been an incident last night in Ferguson, a car apparently bumped into someone who was out on the streets, and some gunshots were fired. What did you think?
I thought not much has changed. Right. I think that's the first. I think that happens several times in the sense that I think there are incidents in which my first reaction is not much has changed. And then I have to go back through the past couple years. Even before August 2014, I think things were shifting. But go back through the past years and sort of think through my head, OK, what work has been done in multiple cities across the states? I think. I also think of St. Louis as a place in which people are right next to each other and trying not to see each other at the same time. So I think everything that happened in August of 2014 and beyond sort of aggravated that juxtaposition.
And you used the term earlier, but this notion of people living in bubbles has come up over the last couple of days on this program and the segment that preceded you with regard to strangers in this land, if you will, immigrants and refugees that, you know, people live in bubbles and don't bother to understand who these folks are.
Right, right. And I think it's really interesting in St. Louis because communities are right next to each other, literally across the street from each other, with these incredible socioeconomic differences. I mean, Del Mar is one that gets called upon a lot, but there are multiple cities in St. Louis.
The Del Mar Divide, you mean?
Yeah. Right, but there are multiple streets in St. Louis where that is readily visible.
Well, the study that was done in your alma mater, the Forsake of All study, for instance, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but basically it brought a lot to light, including the fact that there can be an 18-year discrepancy in life expectancy in adjacent zip codes.
Mm-hmm.
And we know the zip codes would be the affluent ones and the ones that are not affluent.
Right.
This has got to be some sort of inspiration for people like yourself to get at and to kind of dig into.
Yeah, I mean first of all, it's shocking in 2016 that is still a reality in so many major cities. But for sure, I think one of the things that I try to do in my poetry is work those juxtapositions. What do those things being right next to each other raise for us? What questions do they raise? What uncomfortable things do they force us to look right in the face? And St. Louis is full of that.
Full of that.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Let's have a listen to some of what you've done. You were kind enough to bring the book along and set it up for us. What you've got a couple of things you can read. What are you going to start with?
Yeah, so I'm going to read a poem that is actually inspired by the protests in August of 2014 from my chapbook, and it's called "How America Loves Ferguson Tweets More Than the City of Ferguson or Any of the 89 Other Municipalities in St. Louis."
Mm-hmm. That's quite a title.
Right.
That is a mouthful.
The title itself. The camera flash seance in the middle of West Florissant searches for ghosts in the street lamps. While black bodies mid-funeral, caped in tear gas, contort into resume bullet points. Our jaws, broke open in grief, make front page in an article that doesn't mention St. Louis, but will win an award for how the photo makes taxidermy of our trauma. Thank God for the internet, how we've taught ourselves to play mortician with each new name we are given, to pinpoint a single faulty organ, mistake it for the whole body, neglect to even ask the bones for a name. Thank God for Twitter, for the microphones and media equipment, for the scavengers' descent onto a single street, for how they ate our terror and vomited a new story, for the blossoming of our messy grief on television screens for a few weeks.
Very interesting. A couple of things strike me about that. Number one, I know you have an interest in the internet, and you're pretty active in the Twitterverse, as they say. But I'm interested in what you say about the media. You don't have a very high regard, I gather.
I do have a high regard for the media, actually. Yeah. I think the media is incredibly significant in shaping public perception. I think it's one of the few public intellectual spaces that we have left, which means I'm really hard on it because I love it. And I think that media, generally speaking, didn't do the best job with how everything was covered in St. Louis. But I think that there were definitely some bright spots in which stories were being told in really magnificent ways.
You know, it's hard to imagine how the Michael Brown story and the Ferguson story might have played out were it not for the Twitterverse, if you will, or for the internet or social media in general. It's changed everything.
Mm-hmm.
How has it changed you in terms of what you do and your professional, if you will?
For sure. Yeah, I think one of the most powerful things about Twitter, so probably two things. One is that it kind of pushes against the idea of boundaries in really interesting ways, in the sense of countries, right? There was conversation going on between St. Louis residents and Palestinian residents, right? Or about tear gas and how to handle that. That's the story that people tell all the time. But there were also conversations across cities, which were really important. But I think the second thing about Twitter that has changed a bit for me is Twitter as a place of narrative and a place of storytelling. And in terms of accuracy, I think that's a different conversation. But in terms of telling an entire narrative, I think Twitter can actually do that in really interesting ways. And that was one of the most important things about Twitter during that time was having real-time testimony available to people.
How do you use it on a day-to-day basis? Putting the Ferguson story aside, how do you use it?
I use it as like a reflective space, which ends up, I think, being the equivalent of a first draft in terms of poems. Mm. But I use it as a reflective space in terms of being able to think through ideas that I'm struggling with at the time. I think it's really important for how we consider community, for each of us to see each other's thought process, right? Like, this is how I struggled with this idea first and came to this point. And I think that's really powerful.
But, of course, you're limited in what you can say in an individual tweet. And yet that may be a discipline for someone like yourself, meaning to have to limit what you say to a certain space.
Yeah, I think I actually it frustrated me at first, and I think I've grown to like it. I kind of think of the 140 characters and even sort of the visual space that you have of the tweet as a form, right? In the same way that you have form poems, you can have form in your tweets, and you can structure them the way that you want in very intentional ways.
Yeah. Well, I think it's here to stay.
For sure.
You have another reading for us, potentially?
Certainly.
I'd like to hear something else.
Yeah, for sure.
You'd be hard-pressed to put the title of the poem you just read in a single tweet.
Right. Too long, I think. Yeah. So I will read one of the poems from the Nat Turner series.
Great.
This one is called Nat Turner Goes Vacationing in D.C. The city is quiet and completely empty. Nat Turner takes his shoes off, walks down the middle of the road, and follows the yellow double line to the heart of the city. He presses his toes into the tar, tries to feel the blood pulsing below the surface. He follows the river downtown. He follows the river to the MLK Memorial, applies his palms to the base. The stone feels cold, memoryless, despite the carved quotes, bloodless, despite the protruding body. He climbs to the top of the monument, leans into the sunset and raises his axe above his head, throws his shoulders down into the rock and chips the corner of King's hand. He thinks it's funny that we took a rock and tried to pull a body out of it, called it honor, named it memory. He leans again, axe above his head, shoulders, and again chips a bit of granite away. Again and again until Nat hollows out a hole. He squeezes the handle, kisses the metal, and drops the axe into the chiseled spot. Hours later, the sun slowly rises. An outline of a black man with an axe spreads onto the grass. Nat turns his back on the monument. There is nothing in memory but a mouthless shadow. He follows the river of blood back down the road, leaves the city-state full of stone and carved quotes, empty of bodies and memory, full of so many shadows and so many ghosts.
What drew you to Nat Turner? I mean, there are many people that one could be drawn to who are writing as you do, but what about Nat Turner in particular?
So I think he embodies resistance in a really interesting way in terms of narratives that don't often get told. So I actually started, I think, with this manuscript shortly after a movie came out, Quentin Tarantino's movie came out, Django Unchained.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people told me that Django was supposed to be the sort of resistance narrative, this enslaved person getting back at his slave catchers type deal. And I was really frustrated because I said, you know, there are plenty of real stories people could have drawn on for it. And Nat Turner was the one that I was immediately drawn to.
Well, if people want to learn more, they can do so by getting a hold of your book, When the Ghosts Come Ashore. Is it generally available?
It is. So it's on Amazon. It's also on Small Press Distribution, and the press that it was published on is Button Poetry.
Jackie Germain, thank you for being with us and for the readings and for your work.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jackie Germain. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.